You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, talking American League East. I'm Matthew Leach. I'll be chatting with MLB.com's five AL East beat reporters. We're talking about their Orioles outfield. We'll be talking about the changes with the Rays. We'll be talking about the Yankees outfield, second base, and coaching staff. We'll be talking about the Blue Jays bullpen. And we'll be talking about the Red Sox, nearly everything at some point or other. Thanks for joining us here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles reporter, Brittany Giroli. Britt, for those of us who are a little sick of winter, and even here in Georgia it's a little gray and dreary, we've got a little actual baseball coming from your club with a mini camp going on down in Florida. As we get some news and some reports from down there, what are you watching most closely from that O's mini camp?
Well, I think first and foremost, you're looking at Manny Machado, who a big piece of this team, of this organization, really, for the next God knows how many years. And he seems to be doing well. He told reporters down there that he expects to be a full go in spring training. He did take batting practice, ran the bases today. The only thing he has yet to do, and this was kind of one of the final tests with his last knee surgery, was laterally play the field, go for ground balls, be able to move side to side without any hesitation. He's very well known defensively, and a lot of that is his range. So that's going to be the last step. There's no rush on that. When you look at it, we're still about a month out from pitchers and catchers even reporting. So the Orioles feel pretty good about where Manny Machado is. Now, in terms of the pitchers, it's a good opportunity for them to look at some of the younger guys, a guy like Hunter Harvey, one of their top prospects who's there, Dylan Bundy, see how these guys are progressing and see how some of these minor injuries that they had cleared up in the winter have resolved themselves.
What will be the plan for Machado this spring? Is he going to be on a relatively normal spring plan, or will he maybe be behind some guys as the workouts and games go on?
I think the plan is for him to have a normal spring training. Like I said, he's got time. And he was delayed last spring. They released low play to him. He had a setback. And, of course, missed the first month of the season. He had that knee surgery well ahead of when he had it 2 years ago. So they feel like his timetable should be pushed up. And given everything that he's doing, I don't see a reason to really keep the kid gloves on. I think when you look at how young he is, how his body's been able to bounce back, I think they're going to want him to get his reps. Now, does that mean they're going to make sure he goes on every road trip, things like that? Probably not. But I do think they want him to get the at-bats because he really hasn't played at 100% in quite some time.
Another name you mentioned is a guy who is consistently intriguing is Dylan Bundy. What's the kind of prognosis for him, both health-wise, but also, you know, more I think, intriguingly, as far as performance and role this year?
Well, I think, and I've said before, that he could factor into the Orioles this year. And obviously when he was first drafted, that was the hope, that it was going to be immediate, had some setbacks, most notably that Tommy John surgery. Now he's expected, similar to Machado, to be a guy who the gloves are off again in spring training. They're going to see what he can do. And I don't expect him to break camp with them or be part of that rotation, but I do think he's one of their immediate options, depending on how he does in camp. This is a guy who people have forgotten about a little bit because of that injury. He's had some down seasons, but he's very much a power arm. Him and Kevin Gausman, who, of course, fans are a little bit more familiar with, has had an impact already on the big league club. But they were supposed to be the future, and I think you're going to see that the future for the Orioles largely is now.
Could you see him being used a little like Gausman has been used so far in the early going, bouncing a little between relief work and spot starting?
Absolutely. I think it's something that manager Buck Showalter would like to have happen. Listen, in a perfect world, you get him up there, you got a 10-game lead, you know, over everybody else in the division, and he's able to kind of take his lumps. But it's probably not going to be like that, as we've seen in years past. They have to do a lot of shuffling with that roster. Bundy, Gausman, guys who have minor league options, get sent down without being exposed to the waiver wire. So you're going to see, like you said, some spot starts. You're going to see him used in relief, maybe long relief if they need it. and he's going to find a way to adapt at the major league level, because the issue with him has always been he's got that overpowering fastball, but does he have the arsenal? Does he have the second, third pitches to really succeed at this level yet? And I think as a reliever, it gives you the opportunity to work with one or two pitches and see how to survive, how to locate. So there's a lot of learning that can be done out of that bullpen as well.
We turn away from the pitching to the outfield, and this is obviously a topic we've talked a lot about over the past several weeks. It seems like we talked about Coley Rasmus. I guess that's still somewhat in play, but a name you mentioned briefly, Dariel Alvarez is an intriguing name. It sounds like maybe a lot of the fans are excited about him. What's the sort of projection for him this season?
Well, he's a guy who could help this team very soon. Right now, he could even make that team out of spring training. I kind of equate it to what happened with Jonathan Scope last year. What they did was they wanted him to be in AAA for a month. Manny Machado, having that setback, not being ready, is really what pushed him up to the major leagues, and his defense is what kept him there. Alvarez has one of the strongest arms in that minor league system, arguably the strongest arm. Batting-wise, he's going to take his swings and misses. He's got a very wide strike zone. He's going to learn and take his lumps as a big leaguer for sure. But I think they're really encouraged with defensively how strong he's been. And if they need an outfielder, and we've talked about the fact that they need to go out and sign someone else, if they don't, he has a legitimate chance at breaking camp. And if not, I think it won't be too long, maybe a slump for the team or an injury or two before he comes up and helps the club. They are very high on Dariel Alvarez. Part of the reason they were willing to let Nick Markakis and Nelson Cruz walk.
In the infield, this is an organization that has clearly been willing to say, we can swallow some frustration on offense if you can cut it with the glove. Do you think that they would be willing to do that in the outfield as well, or is that equation a little different?
I think that equation is a little bit different. I don't know how much so. You know, they have been willing to do that in the past, like you mentioned, and Buck talks about it a lot. He says, you know, there's going to be ups and downs, especially for young players. He understands that. But penciling you in the lineup depends on, can you defend? I mean, you look at the Gold Glovers that they've had and just how well they've been represented in terms of defensive metrics, and this is a team that really prides itself on making the plays and on taking away hits. So when all said and done, defense is first with this club, and that's what could really help Alvarez as well. The fact that he's so good defensively, they'll take some ups and downs, some lumps with the bat because of how strong he is and how good of an outfielder he projects to be. So I certainly think that's going to factor in as well, and that's a reason why this organization is so high on him.
And then to bounce around a little further to yet another completely separate topic, there's a subject that's kind of it's come up a lot, and it's come up enough times over the last month or so that it's hard not to wonder if there's at least some fire to the smoke. There are now new reports today that there may be some conversation between the Orioles and the Blue Jays about finding some way for Dan Duquette to go to an executive role in Toronto. From the Baltimore side, what is your understanding of kind of how that dynamic works, whether he is looking for other opportunities, whether there's any frustration? What's your kind of read on that situation with Dan Duquette and his current situation in Baltimore?
Well, there certainly, when this first came out around the winter meetings time, there was certainly a kind of a divide, it felt like, in the organization. There were some who were willing to let him go because it would be a promotion. And there were some, of course, including owner Peter Angelos, who were very public in the fact that they wanted to keep Dan Duquette. Now, as you mentioned, there's another wrinkle, another report today that they've discussed at least a compensation package, so nothing is close in that regard. But it's interesting for several reasons. One, the Orioles really haven't done anything this offseason, so of course fans are going to wonder, does Dan Duquette have one foot out of the door? Two, this is a divisional team. This is an opponent. How will this play out if he ends up going there for a promotion, if they work out a compensation package? It'll be very hard from a PR standpoint for the Orioles to sell that and to say, you know, this is for our best interest, because they haven't made really any moves. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I don't expect Dan Duquette to leave, but the fact that this keeps coming up, you've heard it enough times. When there's enough smoke, there's certainly fire. And this is one rumor that doesn't seem to be going away. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the course of the next few weeks in terms of where Toronto stands. I don't imagine anyone, including Duquette, will have anything publicly to say about this, but it just shows the commendable job that he's done. This is a guy who couldn't get a job, was out of professional baseball for 10 years, and now he's being coveted to be a CEO of the Toronto Blue Jays.
There's been enormous stability in the Baltimore organization. It seems like a big part of the success they've had is having that group together, having them on the same page, having them understand how they work together. How much of a challenge would it be? I mean, it's a challenge any organization if you've got to reshuffle your front office, but how much of a challenge would it be for this organization in particular to kind of try and find a new way if Duquette were to leave? How tough would that be for them to overcome, just given how that stability has been such a big part of what they've done?
I think it would definitely be a challenge because you mentioned the stability. And, you know, it's no secret that Buck Showalter and Dan Duquette were extended through the same year, and they've really done a commendable job. Now, would the rumors return of manager Buck Showalter going upstairs, being the GM, and then hiring someone under him? That's certainly an avenue that they could take if Dan Duquette was to leave. Now, you could argue, Buck's such a great in-game manager. How would he fare as a GM? How would he do negotiating with people like Scott Boras? And, you know, I'm not so certain that he would make a better GM than a manager at this point, but he really hasn't had a whole lot of experience. He was kind of a pseudo-GM, has had a heavy hand in what happened in Arizona when they built that organization from scratch. But it'll be something to monitor. I don't know how they'd be able to replace a guy like Dan Duquette immediately. He seems to balance out Buck, big on the player development. And some of the smaller moves that he's made have been absolutely huge for the Orioles down the stretch. And I just think him and Buck together is kind of the perfect fit right now for this club. It would definitely leave a huge hole if they were forced to find a replacement for him.
All right. Well, thank you, Brittany Giroli. Thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, let's take another swing at that dead horse before we go anywhere else. Max Scherzer is still not signed. The Yankees are still the Yankees. Can you give us a different answer, different version of the same answer as to whether there's any likelihood that there's a fit between now and when spring training starts?
Well, I can tell you that I refuse to close the door on it just because the Yankees are who they are. They have the financial resources that if they wanted to do it, they could. But everything you hear coming out of the Bronx is that they are not going to do it. Brian Cashman and Randy Levine, the team president, have both gone on the record and said Scherzer is not a likely landing spot for the Yankees. And Hal Steinbrenner backed that up at the owners' conference this week. He didn't completely say no. He basically said, you know, the winter's not over yet and we'll see what happens. But if you connect the dots here, the Yankees' payroll is probably going to be somewhere around $210 million, and that's even before you would put Scherzer in there. They're giving huge commitments already in the rotation to CeCe Sabathia and Masahiro Tanaka. Can they really add another $25 to $30 million pitcher per year to that rotation? I think there's a lot of fans out there who would say, sure, why not? But Hal Steinbrenner has said that a team should not have to have a $200 million payroll to be competitive. They're already over that. Everything, all the smoke signals are saying they're not in. You know, we'll see. When he's actually at a podium wearing somebody else's hat, I'll believe it. But if you ask anybody with the Yankees, Scherzer's not coming to the Bronx.
If they were to make any more roster adjustments between now and when camp opens, what do you think it would most likely be?
Well, I think the rotation is one area where I would see them upgrading. They've obviously done a lot of work to revamp that bullpen. When you look at the rotation, you say there's question marks all throughout that. You know, who knows if Tanaka, one pitch in spring training, could blow it out. Who knows what Sabathia is going to be coming back from his knee clean out. You know, Michael Pineda was great when he was on the mound, but that was only half the season. Eovaldi's not a finished product, and Chris Capuano is a journeyman. So, you know, I've just gone now 1 through 5, and I think we pick up – it's hard to say any one of those guys is going to go out and be a dominant, absolute 100% surefire force in that rotation. So I think that at this point in the offseason, though, if they're not going to go after a guy like Scherzer or James Shields, which, again, all indications are that they're not, you're looking at kind of that second tier of guys out there, and none of those guys are really going to knock your socks off. So I think that that's why you hear so much speculation, certainly not within the organization, but outside of it, of, you know, when are they going to get involved in Scherzer? When are they going to go after Shields? Because you add one of those guys to that rotation, it would look a whole lot more formidable.
Some news the Yankees did make this week, seemingly one of the most closely followed coaching announcements in a long time. They hired Jeff Pentland to be their hitting coach and did a couple other adjustments to their coaching staff without making too much of guys who don't actually play. What do you think it indicates the choices they made on their coaching staff?
Well, I think that Pentland comes with a track record. You know, he's been around this game now for over four decades. He's been bouncing around. He's been a hitting coach in many different places. He even worked with Carlos Beltran in Kansas City, so he's got a prior relationship there. But he was Girardi's hitting coach, Joe Girardi, when Girardi was a player with the Cubs. He's also been on coaching staffs with Larry Rothschild and Tony Pena in the past. So it seems to be a good fit. You know, who can tell for sure what the impact of a hitting coach is going to be? And obviously now he's got a lot of relationship building to do with everybody pretty much other than Carlos Beltran on that staff. But, you know, that's what spring training's for. You get that 4 or 5 weeks to build a relationship. And really the most important thing that Pentland needs to do is get the trust of players. You can't overwhelm them. You can't try and overhaul everything. Look, these guys, they're professional athletes. They're here for a reason. They've hit for a long time very successfully. So really, you just want to be that extra set of eyes. You want to be that trusted voice in a guy's ear that says, hey, you know, don't tap your toe, or hey, you know, pick that elbow up, or, you know, stride into the ball a little bit. You know, it's these gentle reminders that you want to give to a player, and, you know, hopefully the players would be receptive for that. I would think that Pentland's been successful pretty much everywhere he's gone, so I wouldn't expect that to not be the case.
They also added a position that's become more and more popular over the last several years, an assistant hitting coach. What was the reasoning there?
Yeah, it seemed like everybody who the Yankees interviewed, according to Brian Cashman, came in and said, this job is just too big for one guy to handle. And it's not just the Yankees. I mean, assistant hitting coaches, I think 21 other teams are currently using them around the majors. So it's more of a recent trend, but it's not a rare thing anymore. You know, it gives an extra guy to be around. You know, if one hitting coach is on the field in the cage, there's other players downstairs in the batting tunnel who need attention. And obviously Kevin Long was a hitting coach, and he was a tireless worker. His nickname was Cage Rat, but you can't be in two places at once. So really that it helps take some of the stress off. There's also in-game preparation, you know, a lot of going over pitchers, a lot of going over video, trying to break down sequences, preparing for upcoming games. That's a lot of work for one guy to handle all the time. I mean, it is a full-time job. And, you know, Pentland was saying once this job starts and when he gets down to spring training, it doesn't stop until the last out of the season, and then they go right into the off season. So it really is a 24 hours a day thing. And if you have two eyes there, it's two guys there, it's better than having one.
All right. Now as for the guys actually on the field, I think we talked about this a little last week, but with Steven Drew coming on board, is he the second baseman, or is that still something of an open situation?
I think on paper right now you look at him as the second baseman, but, you know, on a one-year, $5 million contract, the Yankees don't absolutely have to be locked into that. They can still go into spring training, look at Rob Refsnyder, Jose Perella, give those guys a chance to show what they can do. Drew could fit in a lot of different places for the Yankees. If he's not the starting second baseman, he might be the shortstop. Assuming something happened to Didi Gregorius, he could be a backup at shortstop. I don't see any reason why Drew couldn't play third. Obviously, they have Chase Headley there. I'm talking more in a backup role. But I think that they're going to give Drew every chance to be the opening day second baseman, but they don't absolutely have to. You know, they started the year last year with Brian Roberts. I feel like I keep going back to that one. They knew that Roberts wasn't ultimately their final ideal fit, but they hung on to him as long as they could, and once they found an upgrade, they pulled that off, and that wound up being Drew. So I think at $5 million, it's an insurance policy. It gives them a guy who's done it in the big leagues, a proven veteran, but, you know, I wouldn't say that Steven Drew is absolutely going to play 150 games second base for the Yankees, because you just don't know that.
Is he cheap enough that maybe to some extent he's a placeholder for one of the kids to get ready at midseason?
I think if one of those guys, if Refsnyder or Perella is tearing the cover off the ball, and especially if Steven Drew has another year like he did last year, I mean, the Yankees don't think that that's going to be the case. They think he can bounce back to the way he was in 2013 when he was starting shortstop on a Red Sox team that won it all. But they think that with a full offseason and a regular spring training, he should be able to get back to that form. But in theory, if he didn't, $5 million, the Yankees can eat that money. That is not an exorbitant amount of money where you are locked into that guy in a one-year contract. You cut ties and say thanks very much and be on your way. But I think a big factor of that is, are Rhett Snyder and Perello the real deal? Or can they come to the big leagues and be impact players? You saw Perello a little bit in September. Rhett Snyder hasn't gotten there yet, but everybody believes he should be able to hit the big league level. We'll see. I think that, again, they're going to have a lot of at-bats in spring training to show what they can do, and if they make an impression, they should be all the better for that.
One area we haven't talked much about this winter, because it's one of the few things about this club that has been basically set, is the outfield. Is there anything maybe not obvious about that situation, or is that as sort of set and kind of cut and dried as it looks like?
Yeah, I feel like that was the one area where you went into the offseason, you knew what was going to be happening, especially, look, if Carlos Beltran comes back and is healthy and has that elbow surgery, he already had the surgery, if he comes back from it without any issues and is able to be what he was in St. Louis, the Yankees are in pretty good shape. That's almost like picking up a new player here. You have Brett Gardner. I don't think anybody complained about what Brett Gardner did last year in left field. Jacoby Ellsbury in center field, he was actually one of the free agent signings who lived up to everything that you would have wanted. I think that he gave the Yankees exactly what you would have hoped for last year, and obviously they hope that there's more of that to come in the future. And then they moved pretty quickly and brought back Chris Young. I know that Chris Young didn't have the greatest time over in Queens, but he got hot at the right time in September, showed he could do it. Maybe this is a better fit for him across town. So you see, he's the fourth outfielder, and he can play all three outfield positions. And, as Ichiro Suzuki learned over the last couple of years, you can go into camp as a backup outfielder and wind up getting a ton of at-bats. So we'll see what happens. But I think from left to right, especially Beltran's the big key. If Beltran comes back and is the real Carlos Beltran and not that guy who was wearing his uniform last year, the Yankees should add a impact player to the middle of the lineup, and they'll certainly put up more runs than they did last year.
All right. Well, Brian Hoch, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, the one area that still seems to be a little unsettled for this Blue Jays club is the bullpen, and particularly the back end of the bullpen. We've recently seen an interesting name come out, and it kind of fits extra well in this offseason of Canada for the Blue Jays. Do you see John Axford as a fit for this club?
Yeah, I think he is a possibility for the Jays. He's someone who said earlier this week that the two sides have been in touch. There hasn't been any formal offer yet, and I think for the most part, John Axford's really kind of waiting around for some teams to really express interest in him. Some teams reached out to him prior to the winter meetings around that time, but he said he admitted for the last month or so it's been pretty quiet. So I think he's waiting for that to kind of resurface again. And the Blue Jays are probably going to be one of those teams. They're going to have to see where that market goes, because they still need at least one legitimate arm at the back end of the bullpen. They still probably need two. A budget's obviously a concern with all that, but Axford's probably going to be available on a relatively low-risk, low-term deal. I don't think he's someone who's going to get a lot of term on that on his contract. So he is a guy. He's been there before. The last couple of years he has struggled. He had that opportunity last year in Cleveland where he was start of the year closer. I think he led the league in saves in April, and then things kind of fell apart with him a little bit just in terms of his overall command, and that's an issue he's had for a while. But he's still a powerful arm down there. He's had the job before, and that's someone that the Blue Jays really need. They need someone with experience, need someone who's done it before, and he could eventually turn into a fit. It's just a matter of whether or not the two sides will eventually be able to come to an agreement on what a fair value on what likely would be a short-term deal is.
Is it entirely a coincidence that, as I sort of half-jokingly referred to, it has been the off-season of Canada for the Blue Jays? Or is there, I realize they're trying to win. They've got a short window. They need to win. But is it any more than coincidence the number of guys they have brought in who are Canadian and now they're talking to Axford as well?
Yeah, it really is amazing. And there was a Baseball Canada event. They had their annual awards in Toronto earlier this week, and you know, when you look around the room, you know, it's an event before you see all the Canadian baseball players, but none of them really had too much of a connection with the Blue Jays. You'd see Alex Anthopoulos and Paul Beeston in there, and that was about it. This year was a totally different story. I mean, just because they have brought in so many Canadians, Michael Saunders, Dalton Pompey still around, even guys on minor league deals like Jeff Francis and Andrew Albers. I mean, there really is the top-to-bottom approach. I think for the most part, you know, especially when you're talking about guys like Michael Saunders and Russell Martin, I think it is a coincidence more than anything else. The fact that they happen to be Canadian is obviously a huge bonus to the marketing department, and I'm sure they're going to take the ball with that and just run and do whatever they can to help promote the product. But in terms of what Anthopoulos is looking at, I think for the most part that is a little bit more of a coincidence than anything else. I think the ones that probably have a little bit more to do with the fact that they're Canadian are some of the lower-level deals, like guys like Francis and Albers, those guys who have pre-existing relationships with some people in the organization, you know, almost as a favor, they get, you know, some depth deals so that they can have a job coming in the spring. And those are guys who probably don't really factor into the major league roster, at least not at the start of the year. But in terms of Martin and Saunders, those guys, I mean, the talent obviously speaks for itself as well, and the Blues didn't take advantage of it, but I think it's more of a cherry on top than anything else.
To go back a little to the bullpen, if it's not Axford, the market is dwindling a bit. Who is still out there that they could add to this mix?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because you know it seems like all the guys that the Jays were kind of just semi-linked to over the last couple of months, they've all gone off the table, whether it's been through free agency with a guy like Gregerson, or you know, even the recent trade this week over Oakland picking up Clippard. I mean, these are guys who, in theory, that the Blue Jays were going to be, you know, at least take a small run at to try and improve the bullpen over the winter, and it just so far it just hasn't happened. I mean, Casey Jansen is still a guy who's out there as well, still looking for a job. And I have a hard time believing that those two sides would be reunited. But, you know, if time keeps going on and neither side is able to find a fix, I mean, there comes a point where it could be possible. You know, other guys who are out there, I mean, the numbers really are dwindling really, really fast. You know, if you get Rafael Soriano or Francisco Rodriguez. But, I mean, all these guys, the Blue Jays are only going to be looking for someone on a short-term deal, probably for enough, not a lot of money. I think for the most part, they have some figures in mind. If any of those guys are willing to drop their asking prices and accept a short-term, low-risk deal as almost a way of, you know, recouping some value with the fact that the closer job would be up for grabs and maybe someone can come in on a one-year deal, you know, build up some value and then head for a big payday next year. I think that's really the only thing the Blue Jays have going for them right now, is that they can sell that spot, which is something that a lot of teams out there can't necessarily say, because they already have ninth inning solutions. The Blue Jays don't. So that's the one added perk that they have going throughout all this.
Are there still in-house options who might step up, who might be more prominent than it would seem right now within the relief group?
The only guy would be Aaron Sanchez, and that's someone who they would like to see in the starting rotation, but they don't have anyone that is slated for relief right now who would really fit into that role. Brett Cecil, a guy who has obviously become a very reliable setup man for the Blue Jays. He was a closer in college. He's closed out a handful of games during his major league career. He could be one option. But then you run the risk of losing him in his current role that he's had now, which he's really settled into over the last couple of years. And, you know, as you know, some of those outs in the sixth, seventh, and eighth inning, a lot of times they can actually be even more valuable than what's happening in the ninth. It's just, so you really run the risk of losing him, but he could be a possibility if they really wanted to do that. Aaron Loop is another guy, similar role to Brett Cecil, who could technically do it. I do think that if the Jays come out of this without any kind of major acquisitions, I think they're not going to necessarily even like it themselves, but I think there is a possibility where you could see Aaron Sanchez down there. But, you know, that we're probably still about a month away from really knowing that for sure. I think still the effort's going to be on bringing in at least one guy to settle into that role.
Do they want to go into camp? Do they expect to go into camp knowing who their ninth inning guy is, or at least having somebody where it's his job to lose, or are they open to going in with a competition?
Yeah, that was actually something, you know, we talked to John Gibbons about at the winter meetings when he was there, and then also towards the end of last year as well, because, you know, there wasn't really, with Casey Jansen seemingly on his way out at the end of last year, there wasn't any clear-cut guys to kind of step in and fill that void. Gibbons doesn't really seem to be a huge fan of the closer-by-committee approach. He does like to have one guy. I don't think he necessarily is 100% adamant that it has to be someone who's done the job before, but he would like to name someone. So I think you're going to see, you know, unless they come away with a big-name guy or a recognizable name over the next couple of weeks, I think what you could possibly see is a competition between a few guys, you know, especially if you know, someone like Axford doesn't come in. I think if Axford came in, I think he'd be the easy favorite. If it wasn't him, then I think, you know, the team had no choice but to probably audition guys like Cecil Loop and even Aaron Sanchez during the spring a little bit, and Sanchez would probably be the guy who comes away with it. But there would be some sort of audition, and there's no question that the Jays would like to have you know, one name that they can go to in most of those situations as opposed to the bullpen by committee.
And one other thing I'd like to touch on, a story that has been going on for a month now. There still seems to be some question as to what's going on at the very top of the Blue Jays front office. There's still not any hard reports. Do you have any read as to whether we're getting any closer to having some sort of resolution regarding Paul Beeston's future with the franchise and maybe who his successor will be whenever that time comes, whether it's now or in the future?
Yeah, it really is kind of an amazing situation just to see how long this has dragged on now. I think today was day 34 since the original rumors came out around the time of the winter meetings that the Blue Jays were talking to other teams, other executives about finding a replacement for Beeston. The thing I take away from all this is that there's no question that there's a disconnect going on right now between Beeston and between the Blue Jays ownership, because, you know, since those rumors first broke about a little over a month ago, you know, from my understanding, Beeston's been telling employees and other people close to him that he's going to be back in 2015. And then you hear reports this week that yet again that the Blue Jays have, or someone on behalf of ownership with the Blue Jays has reached out to, you know, other teams, in this case Baltimore, with Van Duquette, to try and gauge interest and see if there would be a possibility of bringing him into Toronto and essentially what would be Beeston's role. While all this is going on, Beeston's in Arizona at the owners' meetings on behalf of Rogers. So it's a very convoluted situation. And, you know, it does seem that there is, you know, not only mystery in within the media and the fan base about what's going on. I think there's a lot of uncertainty even within that own organization as to what direction is being taken right now and just the timeline more than anything else. I think it's pretty obvious that eventually Beeston is going to step aside. But it hasn't been a smooth transition by any means so far, because on one hand, there's a lot of people saying he'll be back in 2015. On the other hand, you have, it would appear to be people who are looking to fill his position sooner rather than later. And that's rather unfortunate for a guy of Beeston stature as well. I mean, this is a guy who dates back. He's a day one employee all the way back since 1977. He had his fingerprints all over the Blue Jays glory years in the 1990s, and since he came back for his second tenure as well, has been part of a brand rebuilding and a lot of positive things that have happened with the organization over the last couple of years as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I don't think it's going to end very cleanly. I think this is a potential situation that could still continue to drag on a little bit. And as we touched on before, it's already on day 34, so we'll just have to see just how far this actually goes.
All right, well, Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter Bill Chastain. Bill, your team has made an awful lot of news this winter, and they continue to do so even now that we're here in January. They made a move that I think had been anticipated, probably with dread by fans, for quite a long time, as they moved Ben Zobrist, a guy who's been a really core part of what's been going on for a long time there. What was it that finally convinced them that the time was right to pull the trigger on a Zobrist trade?
I think it mostly was the what-if chance that he got off to a bad start. They weren't doing well, maybe, what happens then? And you've got a guy, you wouldn't have the same value he has right now. He's probably at as good a value as he's going to have. The only thing probably could happen was his value would go down once the season started. And based on what they got in return and what they will, have for the future, it just looked like a perfect storm to facilitate that to happen finally.
I saw one reporter, maybe it was a tweet, that suggested that part of that deal was, and it looks that way in retrospect as Escobar got flipped, was not that the A's were particularly hungry to add Yunel Escobar, but that, in fact, part of the deal in order to get Zobrist was for the Rays to take Escobar. Is that an accurate way of looking at it in your understanding?
Definitely. And, I mean, I don't think I think when Rays fans look at the deal, they should also think about that in terms of that the Escobar that they had the first year was not the Escobar they had in the second year, and they were married to him for two more years. So I think that was, and who knows, Escobar could very well go out to Washington and look like he did in 2013, but it looked like whether he was disenchanted with the Rays, whether he just had a bad year, I don't know, but it looked like he checked out last year, and I think getting rid of him was probably a good signal for the clubhouse as well as for the overall benefit of the team.
So, in the immediate term, where does that leave the Rays' middle infield for 2015? Who's their second baseman and who's their shortstop?
Well, I think it's Cabrera at shortstop. And then you're going to have, Logan Forsythe, Nick Franklin, and Tim Beckham at second. And all those guys, I would look at Beckham and Franklin at shortstop as well. I actually saw Beckham yesterday, and he looks great. He had hurt his knee last year, and of course, for those who don't remember, he was the number one pick of the 2008 draft. He looks in great shape. A lot of the guys with the Rays were talking about his mind's in the right place, and how you can actually tell if somebody's been putting in the work. He just kind of seemed to have a glow about him. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him really work himself in there for some playing time. But and then you've got your corners. So, I think Cabrera is a pretty solid addition at shortstop when you're getting rid of your shortstop.
Cabrera, as you and I think a lot of people noted, will be making basically what Zobrist makes in 2015. In dealing Escobar, they do clear up a little more payroll space. Now, this club said going into the winter, they made no secret that the payroll was going to be a little lower in 15 than it was in 14. But is there now flexibility to spend a little more on another piece or two, or are they basically done with additions?
You know what? That's a hard call to say. I know, if you looked at who they might trade or who they might sign, I was thinking, they still might trade DeJesus, but he also looks like he could be their option as a leadoff hitter against right-handed pitching. But you look at what they have in the field, and save for maybe finding a big bopper, and I don't think you're going to find him such an animal for the kind of money they have left. I don't really see anything they need in the field except for maybe a backup catcher if they're not going to go with Kurt Casale. I don't think John Jaso is going to get a lot of reps at catcher. They're a little bit, he had the concussion problem last year, and he has been cleared, but I don't think they're making catching a priority for him. So I wouldn't be surprised if they carry three catchers if you're including Jaso. And on that same line, whether or not they found another catcher with that extra money you're talking about in theory, that could be a question as well.
Any likelihood they still do anything to the bullpen?
They're starting the season without having Jake McGee, even though he's not going to be lost that long. In the past, they've kind of gone and found the veteran guy that Jim Hickey can work his magic with a little bit, and they signed him to a minor league deal, invite him to camp, and they seem to have had had some success doing that. So that's about the only thing I could see them do. I mean, they've already. They brought in Jepson, and they think they can get something out of Ernesto Friere. So, those are all back-of-the-end guys if they're doing well. And, of course, if Balfour ends up being what they initially thought he was, that's going to be a bonus. But
you know, he obviously had a bad year last year, but he finished strong in September. So I don't think they're looking too bad bullpen-wise.
This club obviously has undergone a really pretty radical reconstruction over the last, really going back 7 months now, 6 or 7 months. One guy who is apparently there for a long time is Evan Longoria. What do you think his take is as he sees? Is he in a position to sort of be understanding that this is going to happen sometimes, or is there any worry that maybe he's going to be a little frustrated or disappointed over how all this has gone down over the last several months?
Well, I can't speak for him, but I know he's seen that happen before. I mean, he saw it going into the 2011 season, and this is just the oddest of organizations because it's like they almost seem to do better when they, you know, tighten their belts and go with the lower payroll. You know, they had the magical 162 in 2011 following, you know, what was arguably their best team, which was 2010 on paper, even though they didn't advance in the playoffs. But, you know, so he's seen it before. He understands what they're doing. So, and in talking to all the players, they're pretty excited about the team they have, even contrary to what the fans think.
What do you make of this offense? I mean, because that's really – I don't think anybody's really doubting the rotation. There's a lot of talent there. There's maybe even the decent amount of depth. When you look at what this offense is now overall and the additions and subtractions and the changes, when you look at the 2015 Rays offense, what do you see?
Well, you got to kind of look at it in two ways. All right, first off, you know, last year's offense scored 612 runs, and the team gave up 625. So as they are prone to say, they like about a 200 or 300-run differential, whether or not it's you score more runs or prevent more. So part of the problem in that last year was the fact that that differential didn't get as good a boost at the early part of the season, in large part because they had lost Cobb, Matt Moore, and Hellickson. So the offensive deficiencies were, I think, more under the microscope because they weren't getting as much on the preventative side. So they get back to that preventative side, and what looks like a dormant offense might look a little more potent, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It is an interesting it's an interesting topic because, as you note, they are not. And as you wrote today, they didn't dismantle an offense that scored 1,000 runs. So there's a little bit of thought that just some bounce backs and some sort of reasonable hopefulness, even with the guys that have removed, maybe it's not. Maybe it is a similar offense. It does seem like it's sort of an interesting question as to are the additions internal just from a Longoria bouncing back and things like that.
And that is a big part of it. And, you know, the funny thing is some of the guys that they got rid of, I think, could go somewhere else and thrive. And, I've always wondered what might happen if Matt Joyce was thrown in a lineup and just, you know, they told him you had a spot every day. Same thing with Sean Rodriguez. But under the Rays system, it just wasn't working out. And I think if you keep, you know, it's like that old definition of insanity, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over. And, you know, they had those guys for a while and it just didn't happen. So, you know, you need to make change when, you know, sooner or later if you're just not getting the results you want. And, you know, not blaming those two guys in particular. I'm just pointing out I think they could go somewhere else and do well. But it just wasn't working with the Rays.
All right. Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter Ian Brown. Ian, you had a piece on RedSox.com this week taking a look at the corner infield, and it looks like that may be the one part of this club where there's not a whole lot of question as to how it's going to shake down and who's going to go where and how everybody fits in. Is there anything maybe unexpected or surprising to see out of first and third for this club as it moves forward?
Yeah. Matthew, I think the one thing, I think people are sleeping on Mike Napoli a little bit because he had a really sort of, I would call it a mediocre year last year where he was just kind of there, but not the Mike Napoli that Red Sox fans had come to expect and baseball fans had come to expect. And just watching the guy every day, the guy wasn't healthy the entire year. I saw him the second week of the season make kind of a foolish head-first dive into second base on about a 28-degree night in Chicago. And he dislocated his finger. And in typical Mike Napoli fashion, he was back in the lineup 2 days later. Well, maybe the smart thing would have been to, take a little time off. And, that thing really limited his power. Then his back went out on him, and just I think pretty much every part of his body hurt him at some point. So I think this guy hitting number six, I think, is kind of laying in the weeds. And if he could have, say, one of those years he had in Texas a couple years back without the rigors of catching every day, I think this guy could make a big difference in the Red Sox lineup. So I would say that could be the big surprise element of the corner infield, is just that people might not be expecting much from Napoli, and he might give it to them this year.
Another guy that I think earned a lot of fans last year and is on the depth chart at about six different spots is Brock Holt. Where does he fit into these 2015 Red Sox?
Yeah, Matthew, it's funny because, we do those weekly inboxes, and that's probably the most frequent question I've gotten this winter. Every week there's three or four questions in my mail, in my inbox saying, where's Brock Holt going to play? How's he going to get in the lineup? Well, I think what they're going to do is, you have a guy who can play seven different positions. He can play all four infield spots. He can play all three outfield spots. So I think that he's the guy. He's going to give guys a break, and I think that he's going to get a minimum of 200 to 250 at-bats. And, at some point, there's probably going to be an injury somewhere where he's going to get a spot full-time for a little bit. So I think that John Farrell's going to keep him engaged. He's going to keep him in the lineup because he really adds to them defensively. I think he's pretty at least average at every spot he plays, above average at some spots. And offensively, he's never going to hit for a lot of power, but he's a nice he's a nice on-base guy. He can hit the ball down the line. Proved himself to be a pretty good leadoff hitter at times last year, so I think he's going to be a real nice piece on their bench this year.
By contrast, and this is something we've talked about before, but even so, it doesn't seem to be any clearer, the outfield just seems wide open. It seems like there are more guys than there are spots. It seems like there are more guys that deserve playing time than there are spots. How does that kind of shake down? How does everybody get at bats, and how does the roster crunch get solved?
Yeah, it's going to be a tricky one for John Farrell, for Ben Cherington. The one thing you know for sure, look, Hanley Ramirez was signed for a lot of money to play left field and to bat cleanup, and he's going to be in there almost every day. Now, there have been some nagging injuries at times in his career, especially recently. So, look, with that depth, maybe you can give him more frequent breaks than he's had in the past just to make sure he can play 135 games for you instead of 110 or 105 if something seriously happens to him. But, where the real logjam is, center and right field, you have Mookie Betts, you have Ruznay Castillo, you have, Shane Victorino earning a nice $13 million next season. You have the three of those guys for basically two spots. Now, I think they want, Mookie Betts to play a lot, and he might even be their primary leadoff guy. Now, Shane Victorino, where that leaves him and his $13 million, that's a big question. And I think that Victorino has been so banged up last year, even the year before that when they won the World Series, and he was a big part of that. He was kind of, on the cusp of DL stints, it seemed like, the whole year. So I think they're really going to pick their spots with Shane. I do see him playing against most lefties because that's really where he's most effective, is against left-handed pitching. And I think that Shane Victorino is going to have to get used to playing less than he's accustomed to. They want to see what they have in Castillo. So, and then you still have Daniel Nava and Alan Craig. And I don't see how Alan Craig breaks camp with this team. To me, he just screams as someone who's going to show himself to be pretty healthy in spring training. And some team is going to look at Alan Craig and say, look, this guy, for his contract, can be pretty good value for our team. And I just see some team making a trade to get Alan Craig. So that kind of leaves Nava as the extra guy with still those other three guys. So it's going to be a challenge for Farrell. And obviously, some of it's dependent on how Mookie Betts performs offensively. We all expect him to be a pretty good hitter, but didn't we expect the same thing of Xander Bogaerts going into last year? And that didn't happen for most of the year. So I think there are some unknown variables, and the Red Sox are going to get a good as read as they can in spring training and then see how it plays out once the games start.
We just talked about the outfield for 3 minutes straight and didn't even mention Jackie Bradley Jr. How does he fit in?
Yeah, Jackie Bradley Jr. right now is ticketed for Triple A Pawtucket, where he's going to go play center field every day, and he's going to rebuild the value that he lost last year. Either that, or they still make this trade that we've been talking about for a pitcher for how many months and how many podcasts now, and he's a piece in a trade, a second or third piece in a trade to get, you know, a Cole Hamels or a or a Jordan Zimmermann or some pitcher who becomes available in a trade. It's hard to see the fit with Jackie Bradley Jr. right now. He's really been sort of boxed out by Mookie Betts, who they suddenly value more. And ever since they signed Ruzne Castillo, that really signaled to me the end of, well, you know, there really doesn't seem to be much of a spot for Jackie Bradley Jr. here with the Red Sox long term.
You mentioned Cole Hamels, and that sort of continues to kind of quietly bubble on the back burner. Recently, it was brought out another, I don't know if you call it speculation, I don't know if you call it a report, that the Red Sox are one of the teams that seem to be in conversations with the Phillies about him, but it's probably not going anywhere. What's your read on the Red Sox and Cole Hamels?
Yeah, I think they like him a lot. He makes a lot of sense for them in a lot of ways. And you look at they lost out on John Lester. Well, here's a guy who maybe a similar pitcher who you can get for a little bit cheaper, a little bit more affordable. But the question is, how much do you give up? And it seems to be haggling over, you know, what they give up. But, you know, the Red Sox have to realize that if they're going to go out and get a pitcher like a Hamels, they're going to have to give up somebody they don't want to give up. They're going to have to give up a Mookie Betts. They're going to have to give up maybe a Swihart. And at some point, I think you just have to say, you know, do we want to do this or not? And, what is our price? So it's just a matter of if the Red Sox deem Cole Hamels to be worth one of their top prospects, and if they can agree with the Phillies. But, you know, I think the Red Sox are one of the few teams that has kind of the depth, both in their system and at the major league level, to make a deal like that make sense. So if Cole Hamels ever does get moved, you know, I'd say the Red Sox have to be, you know, one of the two top candidates where he's going to go.
And while we're talking about guys who look like number one starters, is Max Scherzer any kind of a fit for the Red Sox at all?
I just don't see it, Matthew. I mean, you look at the money they were not willing to spend on John Lester. I mean, I would be shocked personally if Max Scherzer is going to sign for any less than John Lester signed with the Chicago Cubs. And were the Red Sox willing to pay $155 million for John Lester? Not even close. I think they knew they had a pretty good idea of what the Cubs were willing to spend, and yet the Red Sox capped their offer at $135 million. So, you know, you never rule anything out. Maybe they have this secret love for Max Scherzer. Maybe they've read through Scott Boras's, you know, 173-page book about why, you know, Max Scherzer is going to be a first-ballot Hall of Famer and why he's by far the best pitcher out there. Maybe the Red Sox are chewing up every word of it. But, you know, I would just be frankly shocked if the Red Sox spend $160, $170 million to go get Max Scherzer.
All right. And then one of the topics you touched on this week in your inbox was how the Red Sox sort of make their embarrassment of riches with young catchers work together. How do you see those pieces coming together with Vasquez, with Swihart? How do they kind of make that work? It's a good problem to have, but it's still something you kind of have to address.
Yeah, no, it's a very good problem to have. And I think that, you know, the real unknown to me right now in the Vasquez-Swihart equation is what kind of hitter is Christian Vasquez. I think you have a pretty good idea of what Swihart can be. You have a pretty good idea that he can be a pretty good hitter, an above-average catcher. Track record certainly points to that. The athleticism points to that. But Vasquez, to me, is real intriguing because this guy, to me, is already one of the top 3 to 5 defensive catchers around. And, you know, Can he hit? If he's any kind of weapon offensively, then this guy's worth being your starting catcher. And then maybe you do say, you know, come midseason, okay, Christian Vasquez is going to be the Boston Red Sox catcher for the next 10 to 12 years. Dare to dream he can be our, you know, Yadier Molina, which is, you know, lofty praise for anyone. So I think you just have to see if that can be the case. And if that is the case, then maybe you can trade Swihart. If it's not the case and he looks like just a guy who's going to hit 240, 250 while playing great defense, then maybe you look at going with a tandem with Swihart and Vasquez and seeing where that gets you, kind of a right left platoon. So I think it's still playing out because you don't know what either one of these guys is going to be just yet.
What's your take on what Vasquez will be as a hitter?
I think he can be pretty good. I think he can be, you know, a 265, 270 hitter, 15 to 20 home runs. Now, will that happen this coming year? Maybe not. It might be another year away. You know, you look at, you know, I mentioned Molina, so, you know, you go back and look at his year by years. It took him, I think, 3 to 4 years where he really became the hitter that he is now. So you just have to kind of see. But I think he has the athleticism. He has the the work habits to become a pretty good hitter. So I just think you have to see how it takes and how he starts to make the adjustments to major league pitching. He had a little trouble last year, but maybe he knows what it looks like to have a face major league pitching. So maybe now you see if he's ready to make the adjustment.
All right. Well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.